Today we're going to talk about statistics and statistical analysis a bit. Hopefully I'll give you some information that is useful for your laboratory classes. But I also really want to give you maybe a feeling for statistics in a way that you may not have seen before. One of the issues about statistics is when you say it, for many people it seems pretty boring. Certainly, it's my experience in some chemistry labs and physics labs is the terror analysis left me crying with boredom. But in fact, it turns out that statistical analysis, understanding quantitative things and how good they are, how serious to take them, is incredibly relevant for you personally. I have a more modern example of this. But I didn't think to grab it last night, so this is sort of an older example. And I didn't write down the reference to this, and I wish I had. But basically, I was watching the news way back when some guy named Bush was running a caucus for presidential election way back when. In the news, they reported that, you know, last month, Bush had a 42-40% lead over Dukakis, and then Bush, in month two, you know, Dukakis, that day they had just done a similar poll, and Dukakis was ahead of Bush by a couple of percent. And they had this major national headline that day that Dukakis surges past Bush in the poll. And they said, they showed on the graphic, on the television, that this poll had a plus or minus 4% error. We laugh. Are they manipulating the public? Or do we have idiots doing national news things? Either way, should we be laughing? Right? That's a pretty egregious thing. They're fabricating a headline there, and it can have real consequences. So, other things. Global warming. I think the case is becoming fairly clear, but people have been arguing about it for many years. And much of it falls into the realm of statistics. Right? What trend is real, what trend is not? Is this something that's man-made or natural? Certainly, where many of you may be headed, all sorts of analytical medical diagnostics you better pay attention to. You know, is this trend real? Is this value really too high or too low or what have you? So you really have to have some idea of what the errors are on any number that you're using, any device you're using. Here's one that comes up again and again and again that sort of amazes me. There have been epidemiological results where people have argued that cell phone radiation or radiation from your computer screen will cause cancer. Albert Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize for something known as the photoelectric effect, where it is shown that ionization happens when you have a photon of light of a certain frequency, but it has to have enough energy to kick the electron out of the atom, for example. If the photon doesn't have enough energy, it can't actually ionize anything. And cell phone radiation is below that threshold by substantial fraction. So the physics of how that could ever happen is beyond me. And I would guess somebody screwed up their statistics pretty royally in that one. But you hear about it again and again and again. Okay, keeps cropping up. So, and if you decided this is really true, then we've got a life changer, right? You're going to really change all sorts of things in terms of how we operate. So, anyway, kinds of things that you can measure quantitatively. That wasn't what I meant to do. So what kinds of things can you measure quantitatively? And you can think of lots of things. Certainly in physics, we're a science where we do a whole lot of that, right? So you can measure motion, velocity, acceleration. These are things we've been talking about. You can measure numbers of nuclear decays. You can measure intensity of light. You can measure spectra. So you can measure how the intensity of light varies with the frequency. So those are sort of kinds of things you can measure quantitatively. Qualitatively, you also make a lot of measurements, right? Error analysis, as we're going to talk about it, is generally thought of in terms of very quantitative measurements, and certainly you really do need to do it there. But you can have some sense of qualitative error analysis as well, right? You may be asked to make qualitative judgments if you go into medicine. Is that inner ear really red and swollen, or is it not? Do I give this kid antibiotics, or do I not? It starts to be a qualitative judgment. And I've had doctors look at me as a parent and say, what do you think? Because there's this realization that, you know, the parent knows the kid better than the doctor does. But there's a qualitative measure in there of I didn't blast you, did I? I did not. Sorry if I did. As you stumble out of here, you can blame me. So what really is the difference between a qualitative and a quantitative measurement?
Qualitative is more like a subjective judgment, and quantitative is a measurement using instruments or observation.
Yeah, one is very numerical, and the other is much more. There's a lot of judgment potentially involved. Right? So, how about, you know, which type is important in science? And I think most people are under the mistaken impression that science is all quantitative. And we do strive to make it as quantitative as possible, but it is not always quantitative. One might argue that one of the differences between social sciences and natural sciences is the degree to which you can be quantitative as opposed to qualitative. Okay. So, anyway, so we try to be exact and quantitative, and physics is probably the most extreme of the sciences in trying to do that. But as you'll see very often in physics, we'll actually make this we'll make approximations to sort of get at the qualitative essence of what's going on, so that the math doesn't really cloud things. Sometimes the behavior is sort of complex when you look at it formally, mathematically, a bit too much. But if you make certain approximations, for example, one you'll see is when we study a pendulum. It turns out the mathematical description of the pendulum's motion is a bit complicated, except at small angles. And at small angles, you can make a nice simplification, and it becomes very easy to understand exactly what's going on. And so so what you do is you demand small angles, and then you sort of make a series expansion and drop the high orders of the angle, and it ends up to pop out something that's very useful for us. So some of you may recognize this guy. When my son was little, much smaller than this actually, he had this toy tape measure. And he would go around the house, and he was very cute, he'd go, and you know, he'd get on the strutty, and he'd have his little work boots on. 2.5. Then he'd come over here, 2.5. 2.5. I don't know why, but everything was 2.5. I mean, I guess I was doing something at some point and I measured something and it was 2.5. I don't know. But he picked up 2.5. And so one day I just said, David, 2.5 what? And he just looked at me like I was nuts. You know, what do you mean 2.5 what? And so, you know, basically any quantitative measurement we make is completely useless in science. First of all, unless you make very clear what it is you're measuring, okay, and make that has to be communicated. But the other thing is, A quantitative measurement in science is useless if you cannot give an estimate of how good that measurement is. Right? That is as important as the measurement itself. Okay, so tell me, what is accuracy? I make a measurement. I tell you it's accurate. What does that mean?
How close your measurement is to the exact dimension of whatever you're measuring.
The truth.
Right, yeah.
Okay. So if God speaks to you and you know the truth, then you can decide that something is accurate or not. Okay? Now, one problem we have in science is I can't say that I haven't known anyone who did not have God speaking to them, but many of us do not. So we have to be a little bit careful when we claim this. How about precision? If I tell you I have a precise measurement, what does that mean? What do you think? Yeah, so in a sense, that's a measure of how repeatable it is that you're doing. It might be dead wrong, but you seem to be getting things within a pretty small scatter. Okay, so that's a measure of reproducibility. So just graphically, if I have a distribution of measurements, and, you know, we're measuring a couple of things, and the truth lies in this circle, okay? And if you look at the scatter of your measurements, if you imagine making a graph like so, here you have a cluster of measurements that are all pretty tightly clustered, right? So it's very precise, but it's not that close to the truth, so it would be not accurate. Here you would have something that is not so precise and also not so accurate. Here you would be very precise and very accurate. And here you would be not so precise but fairly accurate. Okay? So I think somehow in English we tend to confuse these words, so I just wanted to clarify that. So the types of errors that we'll talk about generally are statistical errors would be one type. Statistical errors come about basically in random fluctuations in the process of measurement itself. So one of the reasons that we repeat measurements many times is to try to get a sense of is to beat down the statistical error, if you will. If I were to try to measure the length of this table very precisely, try as hard as I might, I would get different measurements. If I took 100 different measurements, I would get many, many different values, okay? And you might argue that there's a reason behind each of these. My head was leaning a little bit this way versus that way. Whatever. But these are effects that sort of are random and a little bit hard to quantify in and of itself. You can't identify a single thing that it might really be due to. But they will tend to make measurements less precise as you try to repeat things. Then there's errors that are called systematic errors, and these tend to result from a bias. I just lost the mic, right? Hello, hello, hello. Okay. Ooh, we even have batteries. Oh. systematic error involved, there's usually some form of a bias in whatever it is you're measuring, and it will cause a shift in what it is you're measuring. An example of that might be if I'm trying to measure the length of this table, and there's a wall here, so I cannot get my head directly over where the ruler is, so I tend to have my eye looking at an angle, and I'll measure the table length to be a little bit short all the time. If I do it 100 times, I'll scatter around that because I'll have a little variation in where I hold my head in a statistical sense, but there will be a net bias, and that would be something which you might consider to be a systematic error. In the real world, sometimes systematic errors are very hard to quantify in great detail. And sometimes, in fact, there's a lot of qualitative judgment that an experimentalist has to use in order to try to get a feeling for the systematic error. And so you have to have some respect for that if you are reading a paper. Let's imagine that we are measuring a particular thing. Okay, it could be the length of time between two stoplights, it could be the length of time, I don't know, one of your friends chugs beers this weekend. Let's hope they don't do this in any trials. But you could imagine doing something like that, all right? And so whatever it is, we measure this process. Let's use a stoplight, because in principle it's supposed to be repeatable. You have a stopwatch and you're watching the stoplight, and you click it on when it turns from red to green, and you click it off when it turns from green to red, or green to yellow. Okay, so it's the other way around, right? Yellow to green, and I do drive. Red to green, and then green to yellow. Yes. So it's basically the amount of time that it's green. And because your reaction time varies, you know, you're going to get some scatter in this. There may even be some scatter in the actual electronics that controls the thing. And so if you were to plot as a function of time an entry every time you've got a certain time, you might get some distribution where the height here corresponds to the number of times you measure something within that time bin. Okay? So that's the basic idea. So you most of the time would measure this amount of time, but you have some scatter, right? So let us suppose that that God does speak to us, so we decide that this is the true value, right? And so in this case, you have this reaction time that varies a little bit, and so you get this basic distribution around this true value. So that's not that unusual of a situation. And in fact, when I plot it in terms of these finite bins, you have this sort of weird structure, okay? And that's very common if you have a finite number of measurements. But let's suppose that you really have no life, and so you sit there and you make an infinite number of measurements, okay? And if you do that, then you would find that you would get a very smooth distribution that might look something like this, okay? So that would be if you were able to do an infinite number of measurements, that would be what we would call the parent distribution, okay? And it turns out for different physical processes, we might have different shape parent distribution. This true value, I'm going to use a symbol which I call mu. And the game, when you make a measurement, really, is to take a finite number of measurements, because most of us have a bit of a life, and we want to do something else, right? And we want to determine mu, and the error on mu, this is the truth, okay? But God really doesn't speak to most of us, so we don't have a knowledge of this. So what we want to do is take a finite number of measurements, and from that, somehow infer the best guess we have for what the truth is, and how good that estimate is. Okay, that's really what statistical analysis is all about. This parent distribution can take different shapes. The most common ones you might see are Gaussian distributions or Poisson distributions. There are some quantities that we talk about when we look at such distributions. So this might be how many measurements you make as a function of time or something crazy like that. And if you were to make an infinite number of measurements, you might, some physical process might give you a distribution that looks like this. This would be more Poissonian than nature. So when you look at such a distribution, there are a few things that we talk about. One is the most probable value. So that's the thing that you would measure the most if you made an infinite number of measurements. Then there's the median, which basically says 50% of the measurements are to one side and 50% of the measurements are to the other side. And then there's the average, or the mean. And remember that the mean comes in with weighting in x, basically. So values way out here will pull the average a little bit if you have an asymmetric distribution. So in general, these three things are not the same. Your intuition, and the intuition I'm going to give to you today, is generally more for Gaussian things. And so with a Gaussian thing, it might be that you may make an error, but you're going to be high about as often as you are low. You're going to be sort of close to the true value most of the time, and you're going to be way off sometimes, right? So that would give you a distribution that looks sort of bell curve, or the Gaussian distribution. And for that distribution, the median, the most probable value, and the mean are all three the same. Okay? But that's not true in general. Alright, so let us suppose that we make a finite number of measurements. Then the most probable estimate of mu is given by the mean of that distribution. Alright, so that's what you use in lieu of being spoken to by God. You say, okay, I'm going to take an average, and the mean is what's going to be my estimate of the truth. And so the mean is nothing more than, you know, you take n measurements, and for each of these, you basically sum the value that you measured, and you divide by n. So it's a very simple thing to calculate. It's a simple arithmetic average of this. So then the question is, you know, how good is your value of that? And let's think about that a moment. Suppose I made these measurements and they were all clumped together tightly in X. As opposed to being loosely. So you can imagine that our measure of the width of this thing gives us some sense of our knowledge of how good our estimate is of the true value. So the error goes sort of like a sum over the difference between the true value and each of these measurements that I make. Okay? But the problem with that is mu minus x is, if this is mu and I have an x over here, it's a positive number. And if this is mu and I have x over here, mu minus x is a negative number. So that if you look at it just by looking at the differences of what you measured from the truth, they'll mostly cancel out. And so you'll end up with zero, which is definitely not true. I mean, we don't have perfect knowledge of the mean. So instead of that, what you want to do is to basically square this so that it's always positive. So now you look at the square of this distance, and the square of that distance, and the square of this distance, and the square of that distance, and you add all those together. So you're looking at the sum of the square of all the differences between what you measure and the truth, as if you knew the truth. Okay? And then out of that, we create a quantity which we use to quantify our knowledge of how well we know mu. This quantity quantifies basically the width of the distribution. We call it the standard deviation. The standard deviation is the sum of the square of all these differences between a measurement and the truth. Okay, that's what this is. The square for each one of these, and you sum it over all of them, Okay, so it's sort of the net total deviation from the truth for all of these different measurements, divided by the number of measurements, so you're looking at the average of that deviation. Okay, but because you squared this, you now take the square root of that, so that you have some measure of the average deviation of points that you measure from the truth. And that is known formally as the standard deviation. There's one problem with this, which is it involves the truth. Okay, so you can't know the truth. So we have to change this a little bit to make up for the fact that we don't know the truth. So what we do is we substitute our best estimate for the truth, which is the average. And that's what goes here. And then because that is basically giving up a little bit of knowledge, okay, we're sort of admitting, okay, we don't really know things as well as we did because we don't know the truth. So I have to use the data to get an estimate of the truth and throw that in. Which means we sort of have to take into account now and make our error a little bit bigger because of that. And so what we do is we put an n minus 1 here when we put the average there. Okay? So this is the form of the standard deviation that you use when you're actually calculating a standard deviation experiment. So this is what you should have seen before, perhaps, and certainly used in the lab and stuff. You okay with that? Any questions? Okay, so let's suppose we start with a Gaussian distribution. Mathematically, it's given by this formula. And the average is right here. This is it as a smooth function of x. And one of the things you'll notice is there's a sigma. There's this quantity sigma, which actually goes into the exponent of this exponential. And it turns out that if I vary this sigma, what I'm doing is I actually will vary the width of this Gaussian. So the quantity sigma, when you look, this particular quantity, when we look at a mathematical formula for a Gaussian formula, is a measure of the width of that Gaussian, which is pretty much the same as what you mean when you talk about a standard deviation of this set of measurements, if they're the kind that are sort of Gaussian distributed. So what I'd like to do is to give you a bit of intuition about Gaussian errors. So probably if you're going to be asleep in this lecture, now isn't the time you want to do it, because this is maybe the most important thing I'm going to actually tell you. One sigma for something that's Gaussian distributed, if you were to sort of draw this Gaussian line through, is roughly half width at half max. Okay, that's if you calculate what sigma is mathematically, that's roughly what it's going to be. And if you were now to take a series of measurements that were Gaussian distributed and calculate them, when you calculate the standard deviation, it would be roughly this half width, half max when you draw the line. Okay? Now, the other thing you get, because we're associating the mathematical formula for the Gaussian along with what we mean when we say standard deviations, you should have intuition about errors, okay? If we talk about something lying within one standard deviation of the center point, if you look at this Gaussian curve and you ask what is the probability that you lie within that region, it's only 68%. If you go to two standard deviations, it's 95%. If you go to three standard deviations, it's 99.7%. Okay? And those are big differences. If you recall on that poll that we looked at, the error was plus or minus 4%. Even if that was one standard deviation, it means every number on that poll had a 32% probability of lying beyond 4% of the number they were showing you, just based on them asking a different 1,000 people. So the poll is completely useless. Okay? If those were three sigma numbers, then that poll starts to be a little bit useful. But you never see people report. I mean, so when they say what the error is, one question you should always have is, how many sigma is that? It's very important. I don't know how many of you were paying any attention at all to things that happen in particle physics, but we discovered a new particle this summer called the Higgs. Okay, did you ever hear about that? And if you were paying attention and reading these articles, you kept hearing them talk about, well, you know, we're sort of waiting to get a 5-sigma result or something like that. Basically, what we find in physics is we make some discovery, have our best ideas, our best estimates of what the error analysis is and everything, and the number of times I've seen 3 standard deviation results go away later when we take more statistics is beyond counting. Okay, so generally in physics, the threshold for discovery is it has to exceed what we think is beyond statistical analysis, beyond our error analysis, by 5 standard deviations. Okay, even at 3 standard deviations, we're telling you there's only a 0.3% chance that if I make the measurement again, I'll see something outside of that. So, you know, you have to take statistics. I mean, it really means something. You have to ask, is this a 1-sigma or a 4-sigma, you know, 3-sigma effect or whatever? And how to interpret that means something. So, if it's a 1-sigma effect, 30% of the measurements should lie outside of that. Okay, so if somebody says I have an error of such and such a size, it doesn't mean you're not going to have measurements that fall outside of that. If it's 1-sigma, you're going to have 30% of those measurements fall outside of that, roughly. Okay, so I guess this makes my point. Right. Even at 1-sigma, this is really bad. Okay. So, alright, so the standard deviation that we have just calculated is literally the error, your estimate of the error for every individual measurement that you make by itself. It's a measure. If I measure this thing now, what is the distribution likely to look like? Where is it most probable? How far out might I lie? I have a 30-some percent probability that I might lie outside of that 1-sigma. It's a measure of how good is that single measurement. Okay? So that is an important thing to get. But remember that we have actually, what in the end you're doing is you're making many measurements to try to understand your best estimate of whatever it is you're measuring, which we've said is the mean of all your measurements. Okay? And then the question is, how good is that estimate given all of the measurements that you've made? And that's different from saying how good is every single measurement. Okay? I'm sorry for all the animations. I did this years ago when I discovered how to animate in PowerPoint. I'm all excited. So everything is animated for about 2 months, and that's when I made this slides. Okay, so points at every, you know, so which do you think should have a smaller error? The error of a single measurement or the error on, you know, n measurements on the average? Is the mean known better, or is each measurement known better? What do you think? What? Why? What do you think?
I think the individual measurements would have a smaller error because if you take the mean that accounts all the errors within your individual measurements.
What do you think? You're the tiebreaker.
I think that the mean should have a smaller error because the mean basically takes the error of each individual measurement on their side and sort of averages it out. So, like, let's say you have an error of +3, but then the next measurement has an error of -3, and it goes back to the same
value. Okay, she says it very nicely, I think. If you're making a single measurement, you will have some error in it, and we've calculated standard deviation as measure of that. If you make n measurements, some of them are going to be to one side of the mean, and some of them are going to be to the other side of the mean. And in a sense, the determination of the mean, that scatter averages out a bit. I mean, it's your offset sometimes one way, sometimes the other. So I hope intuitively you can see that we should have a smaller error on the mean itself. So this is the error on the mean, and it's built out of the error of the single measurement. So you calculate the standard deviation, which is the error on each single measurement. And then the error on the mean, so this is generally the error on whatever it is you're really trying to measure, okay, with your end measurement. That error goes down with the number of measurements you make by the square root of n. And this is statistical error only. You have a systematic error involved in this. They're all exposed to that. So you may be measuring very precisely something that is way off. We have something sort of funny that happens in particle physics labs where I work, where we deal with beams that in some instances are, you know, micron beams. I've worked in an accelerator where we're literally taking beams of electrons and beams of positrons and collide, and they were, you know, 1 by 3 microns in size, and colliding them at very high energy, like they were shooting 2 bullets from 2 rifles at one another. And in order to do that, you have to have all the components in the accelerator aligned very precisely, very carefully, and you have to know where everything is for the beam to go through things properly. So one of the things that's really pretty funny when you work with teams of surveyors who are trying to get things down to the nearest millimeter to micrometer, okay, is they'll have it known very, very well to the nearest micrometer, but they'll be 1 meter off. So that definitely happens. So anyway, this you'll have to know. There's another thing that's very important here. This square root can kill you. Okay? If you're doing a measurement that is statistically limited, you can improve that by asking for more funding and hiring another grad student or whatever to do more measurements. But the lifetime of a grad student is limited. So, you know, you start losing by, if you want to improve it by a factor of 10, you have to take 100 times more measurements. You do that a couple of times and you're going to get a bad rep with the grad student. So that's a very important factor. So let's just do a quick little example. I think I did something like this on the exam. Some say if Dante were alive now, he would describe hell in terms of taking this course in physics. One vision that I've brought to mind by some of the comments I've heard is that of the devil standing over standing over a pit of hell, completely dropping young and innocent students into the abyss in order to measure g, which is the acceleration due to gravity. So Earth is pulling down, there's a net force, so there'll be an acceleration of any object if you drop it. And so one of the ways to measure g is to literally drop it, you make some measurement. And so the devil does this and drops 5 students, and there's a scatter in the acceleration due to g that's measured. So the average acceleration, so the best value that the devil measures is the mean. So you take each of these and you divide by the total number, so you get 9 meters per second squared. The standard deviation is the square of the differences of each of the measurements, all 5 of the measurements, with the average that you have here in each of those spots. And then you divide by n minus 1 and take the square root. So that's sigma. And so each individual measurement is done at a level of 0.12 meters per second squared here. The error on the mean itself is this error in single measurements divided by the square root of 5, and that's much smaller. So if you were to now give, you know, if the devil were to publish a paper, In my lab at Hell University, we have measured the acceleration due to gravity of 9 plus or minus 0.05 meters per second squared. So that would be what you have to do. If you just said 9, I mean, it just makes no sense. You have to put in the notes. So good. We've been talking about things that depend only on a single measurement, the length of the table, the time it takes for this thing to change. Okay? The problem that you're going to run into is that almost anything you measure is going to depend on more than one variable. Okay, there'll even be a functional dependence. So suppose that anything you measure, like the period of the pendulum, okay, that may well depend on the error that you have in your ability to time things. It may have to do with the error that you make on your ability to measure the pendulum ball mass. It may have to do with the error that you make in measuring the pendulum length. And the period can depend on all of these things. Okay, so when you ask what is the error in the period, you have to know the error in the mass, the error in the length, the error in the time, and then you have to know how does the error in the period depend on all of these things. Okay, so functional dependence. So let us imagine that we ask if I make a measurement y, and it depends functionally on something else x that I've measured. If I have an inherent error in x, so in this example it might be this is the pendulum period and this is the pendulum length, okay? So I have an inherent error in the measurement of the length of the string for the pendulum, and it turns out that will translate into an error in the pendulum period, okay? And so here's the measure of the length, and this is minus and plus one standard deviation, and if the functional dependence of how the period depends on the length looks like this, then that would translate into this kind of error in the pendulum time. But you might have a different dependence, okay, where the same error in this quantity gives you a much bigger error in this quantity. So the problem is when you're looking at a quantity that depends on multiple variables, it will have a certain dependence on your knowledge of each of those variables. And you have to take that functional dependence into account. Otherwise, you can't figure out how to combine those errors into a final error. So, here's examples of different formulas that the force, the momentum, the position, all depend on multiple things. So if you have an error in each of these measurements, you need to know how that error translates into an error in position if that's what you're after. Okay? So we have to imagine that whatever it is we're trying to measure may depend on a number of different other variables. Okay? And there will be some mathematical relationship that you use to calculate. So then the question is, given this situation, how do we figure out what is the error on this thing we're trying to measure? And unfortunately, to do that, it's a multivariable problem. Okay? And some of you may have had multivariable calculus. Most of you probably haven't. All right, so we're going to do multivariable calculus now. You're used to thinking of a derivative as getting the slope of the function at a given point, right? But imagine now that you have two variables. So you don't have just a line function in two dimensions. You have a variable this way and a variable that way, so that you have a surface, right? So you could imagine now defining two different types of slopes. One being, at a given point, the slope with respect to one of the variables, and the other being, at that same point, the slope with respect to the other variable. So maybe a way to think of that is imagine standing on a surface, and we're literally talking about maybe gradients of the surface. Okay? So we're in a mountain range, you know, that's north, that's south. You can imagine, you could say, how steep is this mountain in the north-south direction, in the north-south direction, how steep is it in the east-west direction? You okay with that? Alright, so that's sort of the game with multivariable calculus, except you don't stop at two. You should have n numbers of variables. So you can't visualize it so easily, but that's sort of the deal. So what you want to do in order to, in error analysis, is you basically want to understand what is the functional dependence of whatever it is you're measuring, the surface, on that particular variable. So you basically want to project out the dependence, or the slope, if you will, in that direction for that variable. And you want to do that for each of the variables individually, and somehow use that to combine to weight your errors in constructing the final error that you've got. So we call these slopes that depend only on single variables within the multivariable problem, we call them partial derivatives, which isn't a crazy name, actually, because the derivative sort of gives you the full slope, and here you're sort of projecting out the slope along a certain direction, if you will. Okay? And there's a very cool thing that you get, which is very important, actually, if you're geeky enough. When you do partial derivatives, the symbol changes from this simple little d that anybody can look at and do to something much cooler. Right? You start whipping out some of these puppies, you're going to totally impress your roommates. Alright, so this is the symbol you use for a partial derivative. Okay? The way you do a partial derivative is exactly how you do a normal derivative. And you say, but you can't do that because you have all these different variables in the problem. You do a partial derivative by doing a derivative where you assume that each of those other variables are constant. Okay? So if I take the partial derivative with respect to x, it is exactly the same as if I took that mathematical function and took the derivative of it with respect to x, where I acted as if all the y's and z's and then whatever other variables I have in there are just constants. Okay? And that turns out to project the dependence of this function on the x. And mechanically, this really isn't so bad to do. So here's an example. Let us suppose you're measuring something and it has a dependence on three separate variables, x, y, and z. And that functional dependence looks like this, okay? So if I want to understand, if I want to calculate the partial derivative of f with respect to x, I say that y and z are constants. I take the derivative with respect to x, so I have 2 times x, which is the derivative of x squared, times the yz cubed. Being constants, they just, you don't do anything with it, okay? The partial derivative with respect to y, and remember, you have a partial derivative with respect to every variable in this problem, because you have a dependence on it. If I take the derivative of this with respect to y, I assume y is the variable, x and z are constants, the derivative of y is just 1, so I just pull the x squared and the z cubed out, times 1. The partial derivative of f with respect to z, I assume the y and the x are constants, I pull them out, and I take the derivative of z cubed, which is 3z squared. And that's what I have here. Okay with that? Okay. Alright. There might be one or two of you that are thinking this. So here it is. Looks nasty at first, but let's look at what it really, really involves. Okay. You're trying to measure, you're measuring some quantity, which I'll just call little f. Little f depends mathematically on a bunch of other measurements that you have to make. And there's some function there, okay? So you have multiple variables in here. So these are the other things you measure, probably the components of the measurement that you're trying to do. So in the pendulum example, that might be the length of the string, the mass of the ball, okay? The ability to time things with the time. So let's look at, so now given we can take what we measure and we can calculate whatever F is, whatever it is we want to measure. That's the average, the mean, the thing you're trying to measure. Now the question is, given our knowledge of, or lack of knowledge, given the errors and all the little things that we are putting together into that equation to create this final thing that we're measuring, what is the error in the final thing that we measure? We call this propagating error, okay? So you'll see it called that in your lab write-ups and things probably. Well, we know that the measurement of F depends on how well we know X. So one component of this is our measure of how well we know X, which is the standard deviation you get in X when you're determining whatever X is, times the projection, basically the slope of the function and how it depends on X. Does it depend a lot on X or a little on X? And that's what this partial derivative projects out. You do the same for Y, the same for Z, and you basically then square everything and add it up. So you basically are taking the root mean square of the dependence of the error on all these little parts, I guess, is the way to think about it. If you have 15 different variables, this thing becomes really unreal. If the equation is big and these can be quite nasty. So you might end up hating error analysis and either having to do lots of algebra to sort of make that work. Any questions about the basic feeling that you should have for this? I'm going to maybe rephrase that. You can hate it if you want, but I mean instinct for it, or concept of it. You okay with that? How well I know each individual piece, weighted by how whatever it is I'm measuring depends on that little piece, and I sort of square them and add them together, and that gives me a measure of the error in the final quantity that I'm trying to pull together. Propagation of error. Oh, okay, so I have all my nice animations we can go through. Okay. So let's just do an example. Let's say that we have a pitcher who throws a baseball a distance at a certain velocity, and what we have is a measurement of the distance and its error, and a measurement of the velocity and its error. Okay? So the baseball goes 30 plus or minus a half meter, and the velocity we measure is 40 plus or minus 3 meters per second, because that happens to be this is a measure of how well our little radar gun works or whatever. So from this data, we want to calculate the time of flight of the baseball. So we know that distance is equal to velocity times time, right? Remember, velocity is distance over time, so you can rearrange the shift. So this is the fundamental relationship of the distance and of the velocity and the distance in order to get the time. We have an error in the distance, we have an error in the velocity. So if we want to know the error in the time, we're going to have to use that formula that we just used. And remember that it uses the partial derivative, that is the dependence of this formula on each of these variables. So we'll have to use that, so I'm going to go ahead and calculate the partial derivative. So the partial derivative of this function with respect to d is just 1 over d. So if you treat the d as a constant, pull it out, derivative of d is just 1. The partial of this, the partial derivative of this function with respect to v is going to be minus v over v squared. Okay, so here is how t depends on each of these basic variables. And now you use the equation that I just gave you. You take the partial derivative of the function with respect to d, you square it, multiply it by sigma d squared. This was the error that I showed in the problem, which is 0.5 squared. So I have 0.5 squared over what b was, which is 40. So that's this term. This term has the other partial derivative times the error in v, which remember was plus or minus 3. So the 3 goes here, and then I have d over v squared. And so sigma t, which is the error you have in that time you measure, is this value. So given the values of the distance and the time I have, we can calculate that t is equal to, and the velocity and the distance, t is equal to 0.75 plus or minus this particular error, which comes from the error in the measurement of the distance and the error in the measurement of the velocity. Okay with that? You can already see that if the equation is a little more complex, it starts to get a bit unwieldy, but that's the way it is. Okay, so I think this is maybe less important for you than it was for me, because you guys have graphing calculators and such, but very often it's nice to put things in a linear relationship, and you'll see some of your labs are probably designed to have you do that. And people used to go to enormous pains to do that, except log paper and things like that, so that when you plotted it, it would come out as a line. One of the reasons for that is because your eye does really phenomenal pattern recognition in looking at lines. So you can sort of see relationships very clearly if they're linear. So if you have a linear relationship, you're plotting something against something else. And this all sort of holds true even if the relationship isn't linear. It's just much harder to see exactly what's going on. But let me ask you, if I were making measurements of y at different values of x so that I got something that looked like this, where these lines correspond to the error in the measurement of y at each of these levels, would you consider that a good fit? And why? Okay, that's a good way to say it. So here's a hypothetical line, okay? And I have about as many points above the line as I have below the line. And remember, these are one sigma errors. What does it mean when we say there's a one sigma error? That means if this is the central point here, there is a 30% chance that the truth lies outside of that one sigma error. So it's okay that some of these points lie off the line. In fact, if these are one sigma errors, you better have about 30% of the points off that one, off that line. If you don't, it means your error size is probably wrong. Or you've been too generous with the error. You can actually make them smaller. Now, is this a good fit? No. Why? You've got a whole lot of things that are really pretty far off. Okay, and it's sort of biased to one side. What about that? It looks a whole lot like the first one we looked at. I think a lot of the logic should be the same. But you've got an issue here. This point has a very small error bar. If you believe that error when you made that measurement, what you're saying is that you trust this one a lot. You believe in that point. That error bar is supposed to be telling you something. Okay? If you say that the truth is here, that's about 4 sigma away or something. The probability of that is really small. Or another way to say it is points with small errors should pull the fit a little bit. So when your calculator calculates the fit, it incorporates a measure of the error. And when it does that, if you were to draw the line, for example, it would draw the line preferably down here in some way, maybe something like that, where it pulls the fit so that it is pulled preferentially by this point. So be very careful about this kind of thing. When you find you're actually manipulating data, if you do something silly like type an extra zero in when you're doing typing in an error for one of your formulas, I mean, it's going to absolutely peg the line right through that point, but it won't be the right thing, right? So visually, you should look at these things, you should think about the errors, and very often it can actually tell you whether what you're doing is making any sense or not. Okay? You guys, these days there's lots in terms of graphical things that you can use. Sometimes it's still useful to actually pull out a piece of paper and draw a graph to see if something makes any sense. Often what's happening inside the computer is not that different from what you can sort of do if you're just looking at it by eye. Okay, so you know, here's a line, we've got a slope. The slope is just the rise over the run, right? And this is the y-intercept, so that's what goes in here. So if you have these data points, you can sort of infer the relationship from it. Then you might ask, well, now how do I get the error in the slope and the y-intercept? Because I drew this line, or I did a chi-square or whatever, I mean, how do I get this error? And, you know, you can sort of get a sense of it. You can draw other lines, and you can say, okay, that one's not such a great fit. That one's starting to be not such a great fit. So the slope actually probably lies somewhere in between what you would get for those two lines. And that is not a crazy estimate of what the error on the standard, you know, what the error in the slope actually is. So you can play that kind of game. There is, when you start to do the fits that are in your calculators and stuff, I mean, it is a very dangerous thing to start doing these fits. I mean, physics lab is one thing, but if you start basing your career on fits, okay, you better know what that program is doing. Right? The computers definitely garbage in, garbage out. The number of times I've had fresh grad students in physics come in and, you know, look, I've discovered supersymmetry. Or I've discovered particles go faster than the speed of light. You know, and you look at it and you sort of dig down and how do you get that? Well, the computer told me that. Every computer program is written by somebody. It has an algorithm in it. You may or may not be using it properly. How do you know? If you mistype something in, an input, how would you know? You better think about these things because you don't want to make crazy claims based on a silly mistake like that. So you should dig down and understand what is actually going on when the time comes. The kind of algorithm that they often use, for example, a linear regression algorithm would be where you hypothesize a line, okay, and then you look at the distance of the data to that line, each data point to that line, and you sum that up, basically. You sum these differences, you square them, so y and m and x basically gives you the y's are your data, the mx plus minus b is what you have for the line. So you look at the difference between the data and the line, you square it, and you sum it over all the points. And you basically now can take the derivative of that with respect to the slope and the derivative of that with respect to b and minimize it, right? When you set the derivatives equal to zero and you minimize, you're actually optimizing this line. You're finding the line that gives you the optimal fit to those points. And when you do things, you know, complicated algorithms that will take into account differences in the errors and stuff like that. But that's the kind of game that's going on inside your fits. It can be a very tricky business when you have complicated things that you're trying to fit. So good luck with that when you run into it. But I think that's all I have. Do you have any questions for me? Okay, there is a write-up in the lab website that you might want to grab. It has pieces of this. There'll be some overlap. And have fun and have a great weekend.